Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. Frank, this has been a long week. How are you doing?
David, if I were, I'm like Donald Trump coming out of the hospital, shot full of steroids. I'm doing
Superman
great.
Superman shirt on underneath what you're wearing. That's good to hear. I think for a lot, we're recording this for historic purposes. We're recording this at just before 8:30 in the morning on Friday, the 6th of November. So just a few days after quote unquote election day. We are still uncertain what the results will be, although listeners, you in the future may know what the results are.
Yes, but it's important to note that we do not as yet know the outcome, although it seems pretty likely at the moment. I think the Joe Biden has just cut Donald Trump's lead in Georgia down to 655 votes. We're waiting to hear from Pennsylvania. That too is narrowing. I mean, basically the expectation is that in the next few hours, I think that Joe Biden will win Pennsylvania and that will give him 270 electoral votes, but we're still waiting to hear about Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, and North Carolina. And Biden is up in Nevada and Arizona. North Carolina, David, I wanted to ask you about North Carolina, which is, of course, not your native state, but your recent home state you know well.
And the state I vote in, yes.
Yes, the state I associate you with. because North Carolina, we need to talk about what we did on election night, but North Carolina has been stuck on 95% of the vote counted for several days now. That's the one that hasn't really moved at all. So I'm interested to hear your views on North Carolina.
In North Carolina, I think the situation was like in most of the rest of the country, that the polling seems to have been off and shifted towards the Democratic spectrum. So, both in the presidential race, but also in the Senate race and in local races, the expectation
shifted towards the Democrats.
The polling had indicated that the Democrats were going to do better in North Carolina than they seem to have done thus far. But as you point out, there's still some outstanding ballots that are yet to be counted. So there could be a last minute shift, as there appears to be in some of these other places. But that does, the whole polling issue seems to be one of the sort of major takes away of this election as it was 4 years ago.
Although Nate Silver tells us he got it right all along. And in fact, he used rather salty language to tell us to, basically we got it wrong because the fact that we can't understand what he's saying is on us, not him.
Him, yes. Clearly that is our fault. Well, we're not math people, so maybe that's the, if we were more mathy, we'd be better.
So David, I know we have to give some, we want to give some historic context to some of what we're seeing, but let's go back to the history of Tuesday. It's Friday morning.
The history of Tuesday,
how did this week unfold for you? Because of course, 4 years ago, we spent election night together, and for the past couple of cycles at the University of Edinburgh, we've hosted with the Student North American Society a big watch party, the largest one outside of London, but because of COVID, we were unable to do that this time. So what was Tuesday like for you?
Luckily, I was teaching most of the day Tuesday, so I didn't, that was able to put my mind at rest thinking about violence of the 19th century. Exactly. I was talking about people killing each other for all day Tuesday. So that was, something I at least knew how that was going to turn out. I decided I've often stayed up all night on election night. And often regretted it Wednesday morning and Thursday, et cetera. So I decided to actually try to go to sleep early on Thursday.
Tuesday.
So it's all blending together. This is the week we're having, I guess. And I got up a couple times in the middle of the night to check things. But then I tried to, maintain as normal a routine as possible. What did you do?
I was incredibly stupid. So, which won't surprise anybody. So I received a phone call, and I can talk about this if you want to. As some of you will know, I've been doing kind of brief appearances every Friday on Good Morning Scotland on BBC Radio with one of our former students, Laura McKeever. and her colleague Gary Robertson. And so I did these. I've done brief little spots every Friday for the past 4 or 5 weeks, talking about aspects of the election. But they invited me to appear on Wednesday to kind of sit in the studio for the with a woman named Laura Maxwell and Gary Robertson for the entire program, which is from 6 to 9 a.m. And comment on results as they came in. And I can talk about that because that was interesting. Yeah. You know, we were there when Trump gave his rather bizarre appearance in the White House and so on. So, but the challenge there is the studio is in Glasgow and you have to be there early. And so they sent a car for me at 4:30 a.m. on Wednesday morning.
And had you slept at all before that?
Well, I meant to, and the producers tried to give me some advice when I was talking to him on the phone, you know, at 5 or 6 o'clock on Tuesday when they called me and invited me to do this. And he said, you should really have a nap now. And I said, yes, 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 of course I will. Of course I will. But I'm, you know, I'm considerably older than I haven't taken naps in a long time in my life.
You might want to reconsider it. Naps are not a bad thing.
Well, no, naps are great. But it's been a long time since I've been able to take a nap because somebody told me to. I have had naps before subsequently. And so he said, take a nap now. But I didn't. And then I made the fatal mistake of saying, well, it's coming up to midnight. I'll just see what's going on in Florida. But of course, you don't hear anything right when the polls close. You're listening to people on the networks bloviate and, you know, and so on. And then it took a while. And Florida was, which we may talk about, was very interesting. And that might be where the polls were most off. But that took a while. And then it got so late, I thought, oh, well, what the hell? I might as well just stay up, which is what I ended up doing. So I ended up staying up overnight and then doing this radio broadcast, which was a lot of fun. And I got back about, I don't know, 11 o'clock on Wednesday and promptly went to sleep. So I slept most of the day on Wednesday, which was actually good because by the time I woke up, they were kind of, you know, things had begun to move a little bit, particularly in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Okay.
But it was a strange, I stayed up and frankly, I'm still kind of working it. You know, there was one point on Wednesday night where I thought, God, I've got a really bad headache and I felt really hungover. I hadn't had anything to drink or like I had jet lag and I thought, okay, I'm too old for this. This was stupid. I should have done what David did and gone to sleep. My wife, who's well known to listeners of this podcast, of course, is Swedish and sensible. So she went to bed at about 9 o'clock on Tuesday night. She said, well, if I stay up, it won't change the outcome, will it? I'll find out what happened tomorrow morning. And, you know, she was perfectly happy and healthy on Wednesday and is a model for us all.
Well, but I mean, yes, to be sure, it doesn't actually change the outcome. But like you could say the same thing about sporting events. You say, oh, the game is going to be a result, you know, that's not going to affect how, you know, who wins the Super Bowl if I go to sleep at halftime. Well, but you stay up and watch the game anyway.
Yes, although I want to return to sporting events because I actually think they color how we watch election returns and it's a bit of a problem, but we'll get back.
No, I think that's right. Yeah, I've had a history of staying up all night on election night and regretting it later. You know, 4 years ago was weird for reasons everyone's familiar with. In 2000, I decided to stay up until there was a winner.
So you didn't sleep for 6 weeks.
Well, the circumstances of it was that I was at the time a high school teacher in Florida. Of course, Florida. And I was also the coach of the women's golf team. And we were at the state tournament. We were actually really good, not as a consequence of my coaching, but the team was good. So we were at the state tournament in some hotel someplace. And I decided to, I literally stayed up all night. You know, I was going to say, okay, I'll stay up to the concession speech. Didn't sleep at all that night. I was supposed to coach a golf match the whole next day, and my coaching was probably not as good as it could have been because I think I was sleeping on the couch in the clubhouse someplace, trying to recover from that day.
You were also 20 years younger then than you are now.
I was also 20 years younger, but I've always needed a lot of sleep, Frank. I'm not I've never been an all-nighter kind of guy. All right, so we've all had this sort of weird experience of sort of waiting for the election results. what kinds of historical context is there for what's happened this week?
We don't know what's going to happen. But look, it looks likely that Joe Biden is going to win. I mean, I think that's, I won't say it's certain until it actually happens, but it seems in the next few hours he's going to win Pennsylvania and possibly even Georgia, the way things look. And he might hold Nevada and Arizona. If he does, he'll be on 306 electoral votes. Well, there's a historic precedent for that, which is 2016, when Donald Trump had 306 electoral votes and declared himself the winner by a landslide. I don't think anybody would reckon this a landslide. I actually think it's been an interesting election, and it appears that, you know, will have flipped the states he needed to flip in order to win. So Biden's campaign was successful, and we might talk about why that was. In terms of the results, I mean, I did a little follow-up interview on Radio Scotland this morning, and they said, oh, has this shown there's real problems with American democracy? And my response was no, actually. When all is said and done, it appears that the better part of 170 million votes will have been cast. And most of them will have been counted, at least enough will have been counted to get a result within 3 or 4 days. That's actually not so bad. So there's been a lot of sort of, on Wednesday morning when I did the interview, and everything was uncertain. It really did seem like, oh God, this is 2000 on steroids, but actually it's not 2000 on steroids. The fears about suppression on the day or violence on the day didn't come to pass, thankfully. And the counting has gone off pretty smoothly. I think Donald Trump is well within his rights to ask for a recount in Wisconsin, where the margin of victory for Biden is only 20,000 votes, less than 1%. We might see something similar to that in Georgia. But those are the rules. Recounts are allowed for in particularly close elections when millions of votes have been cast. I actually think the election itself went off better than I thought. And in terms of precedence, I think it was more like what we might call conventional elections of the recent past, not the kind of horror shows we've seen. Horror shows might be overstating. We didn't get a kind of crisis like we did in 2000, or we can go back to other close elections. It was perhaps close, and it was close in certain states, and the inequities built in the electoral college system were kind of brought home to people. But I think the election went pretty well. I realize we're not over the finish line yet. So everything I say could, we might have to delete this podcast, but what do you think?
Well, I think you're right in as much as we don't have the hanging Chad situation in Florida, at least not yet. And obviously that took weeks to unfold. So we may end up with something similar to that, where they are really sort of scrutinizing individual ballots and trying to figure out things, and it ends up in the courts. I think there are sort of bigger structural problems with the ways in which the United States conducts elections.
Oh, agreed.
The Electoral College is one, but I think also the sort of the mechanics of voting is. Especially in the aftermath of the Supreme Court striking down the Voting Rights Act, the fact that so many Americans have to wait hours to vote is deeply problematic. And I think there's structures in place that make it difficult to vote and discourage people from voting and make it easy to disqualify voters and votes. I think that's suggests a system that isn't wired the right way. I think from the outside, looking at it from democracies that don't seem to have those problems, they look at the United States and they say, well, why are people waiting hours to vote? That never happens here. And the fact that the rest of the world can figure it out, the United States seems to have systems in place which make it put barriers to voting, I think is a real problem.
Yeah, although I mean, I agree with everything you've just said, and there's no doubt that the system needs reform, and those barriers have been put up, frankly, by Republicans to try and prevent people who are predominantly Democratic from voting. So I'm not
disputing that. And predominantly Black, and poor.
However, David, 170 million people voting is a little bit different than an electorate of, you know, less than 5 million people in Scotland. The U.S. voting is more akin to the votes, to voting that in India when an election's happened in India. And in, you know what you see in India? Long queues to vote. Again, I'm not saying we shouldn't have, I want to make quite clear, I'm not saying this, these are not structural problems, but I think the scale and scope of this is pretty significant. I mean, the United States, from I measured this morning, well, I checked it on the, I didn't measure it, I Googled it this morning. You know, the distance from Honolulu to Bangor, Maine is 5,200 miles approximately, right? That's the same distance as Edinburgh to Los Angeles. So it's a big country. It's a huge, with a huge population. It's not easy to carry out an election on such a scale. And the fact that the election was carried out on such a scale, particularly when one of the political parties was actively trying to dissuade people from voting, I think is a remarkable achievement. The system needs reforming, but I'm not so sure that, you know, pat comparison saying, oh, well, they do it so well here. Yeah, they do it better in other countries. But I think we have to respect the achievement and what was pulled off this week. That's not an easy.
The election workers did remarkable work given the handicaps that they had.
You know, right.
We the people who are sort of nonpartisan election workers, and that's most election workers. You know, the people who are volunteering, the people who are doing that professionally, they did a remarkable job. Without necessarily all the tools they should have had to make their lives easier.
And the people who voted, you know, because
the people who voted did a good job too.
Yeah, there were barriers, you know, they shouldn't have had to wait in queues for hours and hours and hours, but they did.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, you know, look, I don't want to kind of go all Frank Capra on us, but this was actually democracy working. And the system needs reforming, and we have to look at postal ballots now. I mean, I think that'll be the lesson. But even then, I'd be willing to say, you know what? The postal ballot laws were premised on, have historically been premised, apart from places like Colorado and Oregon, where postal ballots are the norm, have been, you know, basically postal ballots used to be for, you know, students on their semester abroad and soldiers abroad, right? You know, it was a small fraction of the electorate would vote by absentee ballot. They couldn't have anticipated when most of these laws were adopted, the pandemic and the fact that the majority of the 100 million people would cast votes before the election. So 2024, we need to make sure we know what we're doing with postal ballots.
Yeah, and we should be able to vote online.
Yes.
Because some people can vote online overseas, but most people domestically in the United States can't. And that's stupid in 2020 or 2024, that's not a option available to people, especially during a pandemic.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, and I think sort of zooming out from the specifics of this election, I think the fact that we've had so many very close elections in the past 20 years, I think, you know, says something about sort of the polarization of the United States. You know, the people who were voting for Trump were doing so for the most part with a lot of enthusiasm. The people who were voting for Biden, whether they were enthusiastic for Biden or enthusiastic against Trump, they seem to be, you know, earnest in their voting. There doesn't seem to be much of a middle anymore. And I think that says something about sort of the state of American politics and American society and how things have evolved from, I think, a very different place where we were in the, you know, 80s and 90s, where there were some lots of swing voters and lots of people in the middle. And lots of split ticket voting. We don't see that nearly as much anymore.
No, I mean, Trump, it looks likely to have lost the popular vote by a greater margin than he did 4 years ago, but he increased his vote total.
Yes.
Because
everybody increased their vote total.
Yes, I understand that. But you know, what one of the questions that you and I think have discussed off air and possibly on air over the past couple of years is, you know, well, we're going to, you know, is Trumpism the disease or the symptom, or Trump rather, is Trump the disease or the symptom? And the outcome on Tuesday or this week would suggest that he's the symptom. So although Trump lost, and I think his, or is apparently losing, and I think his personality and his interventions have been contributed to that, the things he stands for were not totally repudiated. I mean, there's a significant proportion of the electorate came out and voted for, and the Republicans appear to have held the Senate. They may not have, but it looks likely at this point, and they gained in the House. So,
And many of the people that got elected, the sort of new crop of Republicans that got elected to House seats, for instance, many of them are in the Trump mold.
Right.
And so I think that's a speaks to the sort of strength of that part of the party, that mode of politics, that kind of ideology, if there is one, seems not just to be support for Trump, but support, you know, more broadly.
Right. But also it should be said, of course, the crop of members of the House on the Democratic side, both in 18 and now, who held their seats to a large extent, but not all, are further to the left. So, I mean, this speaks to the polarization you're talking about. We talk about red and blue America. There are two Americas, and there's no doubt about that. I don't think it's as convenient as saying, you know, regions, although it can appear that way because the electoral map. I think it's an urban, there's urban and suburban America on one side and ex-urban and rural America on the other. I mean, I think that split probably tells us more, but there are definitely two Americas. There's no doubt about that.
I mean, and the point this reminds me of historically, this seems a lot like the period between 1876 and the end of the 19th century, so the last quarter of the 19th century, in which you do have very close elections. All of those elections are close. In many cases, the winner has, you have a couple of situations there where the winner doesn't win the popular vote, but wins the electoral vote, oftentimes very narrowly. You have a handful of swing states, but a really deeply divided country. And one in which the politics is very dirty. The politics is potentially, quite corrupt. And it sustains itself for a very long time. And so I think we're in a very similar kind of Gilded Age moment.
Well, and if you think about the economics of this moment the fact that we've got oligarchs and several industries are incredibly important, but these are virtual industries it's cyberspace where we're dominated by a few large corporations. But I think there really are resonances. But let me remind you, a few weeks ago, we were thinking, oh, is this like the 1850s? As bad as the 1880s and 90s were, they're better than the 1850s, because we know what the 1850s led to.
Yes.
And the Gilded Age was followed by a period of reform. It was followed by the Progressive Era, which, not perfect. Look, I'm not here to speak up for the
Progressive Era's got problems.
I get that. But considerable reform, followed. There was a reaction against all of that.
I am concerned, though. I mean, I'm with you. I'm optimistic that Biden's going to win this election, just given he has more paths to 270 than Trump does right now. This is me being the pessimist again. I am very worried about what Trump says and does based on what he has said and done for the past 4 years, and especially what he's said and done since Tuesday, about what Trump's going to do if and when Fox News calls the election for Biden, and what Trump supporters are going to do if and when that happens. So it could be, thinking about, I don't want to predict another civil war, because that sounds awful. And in my most pessimistic moments, don't envision that. But I think there could be some real political violence in the next month or two.
I agree completely. So all of the optimism and the kind of Pollyanna perspective I shared a few minutes ago about the election itself and how it all came off, I would qualify that massively by saying I'm really, really worried about the transition, because I think we're in a moment, and this is where individuals matter. I think Trump's personality and Trump's power over some of his followers is such that this is we're going to have a very perilous and uncertain time between now and the inauguration. of assuming it's President Biden. I mean, unless we need a real a kind of massive turnaround in the next 24, 48 hours for it to become, for Trump to win, I think.
Yeah.
But whether he will go, you know, there were two things that people have been sharing on social media in the past 24 hours that I've seen. One was McCain's concession speech from 2008. But even more powerful was, to me at least, Jonathan Friedland, the Guardian columnist, shared a video of George H.W. Bush's concession speech in 1992. And he says, you know, it's really worth watching. It's only a couple of minutes, but he said, you know, I just called Governor Clinton and wished him well, and he ran a really good campaign. And, you know, it's really important that we pull together on behalf of the country, and my administration will work with his team to make sure everything goes as smoothly as possible. Now, yeah. One had, look, I wasn't the greatest George H.W. Bush fan, but and at the time that was unremarkable because that was the norm.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the norm until now.
Yeah.
But I just don't see Trump and his team taking the high road on this.
No.
And I'm really, really, I share your concern about that. And we haven't seen any outbreaks of violence this week. And for that, we should be grateful. But we have seen some expressions of anger. And once the results are confirmed, you know, one has to worry about that, I think, given the
especially if the president says the results are not legitimate, which he seems to be, you know, he's claiming voter fraud, and he's claimed voter fraud in election night, election morning, you know, and he's claimed voter fraud yesterday. And so I think that's leads to a potential for a really chaotic situation potentially, and things can spiral out of control faster than we can recognize.
I agree with you.
I'm very worried about that.
Yeah, me too. I share your concern about that. Let me ask you this. I was trying to think of precedents for the voter fraud accusation, just coming from a national figure. And the only thing I could come up with was 1824 and Andrew Jackson having lost that close election, claiming there was a corrupt bargain. Does that meet the standard for a comparison to you, to your mind?
Well, so in that case, I mean, that's voter fraud where they're talking actually about the you know, actual electors in the Electoral College. So the number of people who are committing, you know, it's not really voter fraud, it's elector fraud potentially. you know, and so it's, you know, fewer than up, it's like 100 people he's talking about there who are being, you know, and they're, of those are only swaying a handful of Henry Clay supporters towards John Quincy Adams. And so, you know, that's fraud in a much smaller kind of way. It's much easier to commit fraud when you have a handful of people than when you're having 300 million people. You know, with some of the election workers, officials yesterday were saying, when people were asking about election fraud, you know, the response I heard from more than one of them was, if there was going to be somebody rigging an election, do you think they would do it this way? Right? Like, you don't rig an election to make sure your candidate wins by 50, you know, 1%. You do it by a substantial margin if you're going to, you know, actually put the effort in.
Sorry, rather than literal fraud, though, I suppose it's I guess it's the invalidation of the result and calling the result into question and claiming that you were cheated in some way.
Yeah. Well, so I was looking at the election of 1876.
As one does,
because that's, you know, and that's one where there actually was voter fraud, right? Like, how do we know there's voter fraud? 101% of South Carolina voted.
They're very enthusiastic about democracy.
Very enthusiastic about voting in South Carolina, which is remarkable considering how many ballots were destroyed as well. So they, you know, must have been 120% of people showing up. You know, and so this is one of these sort of pivotal elections in American history, but you have at the end of the regular sort of election season, you know, the electoral votes from four states in question. Well, three and a half states, really. Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina had massive, like, legitimate voter fraud. People stuffing ballots, people destroying ballots, people showing up at election places with guns, telling voters what's going to happen to them if they don't vote the right way. you know, voter intimidation, actual people getting killed on election day, you know, real kinds of shenanigans of a variety of kinds happening in all those places. And really kind of bare knuckle politics in the way that we've not been used to in the United States recently, but seems to be coming to the fore in the past 4 years. You know, and the context for this election for 1876, for those who don't remember this election or haven't studied it, you know, this is an election that happens where there are three major big issues. One is Reconstruction, which has been going on for the past decade. What is going to be the role of the federal government in guaranteeing Black freedom in the South and making it meaningful? Second issue is corruption, both at the national level with the Grant administration and at the local level. And the third big issue was the Panic of 1873, this economic crisis. And the two candidates were Rutherford B. Hayes, governor and congressman from Ohio and a Civil War veteran who was a somewhat unremarkable middle-of-the-road Republican candidate. And Samuel Tilden, who was a politician from New York, who was famous for fighting corruption. He's the one who got Boss Tweed in jail. And New York at that time was an important swing state. And, you know, and they have the election. They have these 20 unresolved electoral votes. And they really, you know, don't have a clear mechanism for figuring out who's going to end up with these votes. Tilden appears to have won the popular vote. He comes with the count going into without these 20 disputed votes. Tilden has 184, Hayes has 165. You need 185 votes. So Tilden's one short. He just needs one of these guys to win. And Congress can't figure out what the hell to do because they've got competing sets of delegates. They end up appointing an electoral commission to decide who gets these votes. They have an expert committee. They have a very complicated procedure for setting up who's going to be on this committee. So they've got five people from the House and five people from the Senate and five people from the Supreme Court. And at the time, if I recall correctly, the Democrats controlled the House, the Republicans controlled the Senate. In those five-person delegations, the majority party gets three people, the minority party gets two people. They're going to pick two Republican Supreme Court members, two Democratic Supreme Court members, and those four Supreme Court members are going to pick the fifth person. The fifth person they ended up picking then gets elected to the Senate by the state of Illinois, so he has to resign, and they end up appointing somebody else. It's a mess. And they end up giving all of the electoral votes to Rutherford B. Hayes, which most people at the time saw as being, you know, kind of power politics in many of the ways, same ways we've seen power politics in recent years, you know, where the party who has the power to do things just does things. And there was a lot of worry in 1876 that there was going to be violence as a response, that you know, this is just a decade after the Civil War. States not responding well to an election and responding with violence was something that was deeply familiar to everybody. You know, President Grant fortifies DC because he's worried about what might happen if you know, Southern states in particular did not like the election results. And the three states in dispute are all Southern states. You know, and they end up cutting a deal, basically, which is called the Compromise of 1877, in which the Democrats agreed to let Hayes become president, but in return, the few remaining U.S. soldiers who are in the South trying to enforce Reconstruction are going to be pulled out of the South. They get a member of the cabinet, they get the Postmaster General, and there's a deal to try to build a transcontinental railroad across the South. But that's a moment, you know, where there actually was real voter fraud, in which there was at least the potential of real violence connected to the election. Now I'm hoping we're not in that scenario, But we can imagine we're not that far from that scenario. We still have a handful of states that are under dispute. It's unclear how they're going to resolve those states necessarily. And, you know, I don't think violence is out of the question at the moment.
I mean, it's a crucial difference is that the incumbent is one of the candidates in this.
Yeah, that's a major difference.
And has at his disposal, at least for the time being, the considerable powers that come with being president of the United States.
That is a very important distinction, yes.
Yeah, and so that's a difference between now and 1876. I do think I'd slightly push back on your, okay, we still don't know about these states. We don't know about these current outstanding states because they haven't finished counting their ballots. So they're still counting their ballots. It's not as though there were like piles of ballots that contradict each other or,
you and I and people who see things, as they are, I think see that, but I think the Trumpists have a very different worldview, and they are claiming, if they do claim voter fraud, the claim of voter fraud in some ways in the world of power politics is the same as actual voter fraud.
Yep.
Because if he says, look, I declare that these votes are illegal and I don't respect, it matters who the, Secretary of State is in these different states, to decide who's going to, which set of electors might get sent.
Let me
get very iffy.
For instance,
there's one disputed elector in 1876, one that could have made a difference from Oregon. And that guy was supposed to be an elector, if I remember correctly, for Rutherford B. Hayes. He had previously held a government job, but didn't at the moment that he was supposed to be the elector. The governor of Oregon decided he thought that was an illegal elector because he had previously held a government post.
That's quaint.
So declared him invalid. So there was like one elector and the sort of, potentially could have made a difference. And I think we're also potentially in that scenario right now. There's going to be discussion about faithless electors coming up soon.
Oh yeah. We're going to do all this. Yeah. We're going to do the whole thing about it. Yeah. This is a hardy perennial every 4 years. So we'll undoubtedly get to that. I mean, you're absolutely right. The danger and the influence President Trump has over his supporters and the need for him to do the right thing. And there's no evidence in his, if this is not a man who accepts defeat gracefully, this is not a man who acknowledges that he's ever been defeated. I totally share your concern about that. Let me offer one observation, however, which is frankly, the Republicans down ballot did better than expected on Tuesday, certainly better than the polls suggested. And frankly, I think a lot of them are pretty happy. I was a little surprised this morning to see Lindsey Graham talking about election fraud because I would have thought Lindsey Graham got reelected. He might think, phew, I'm going to outlast Donald Trump. I don't need to keep doing this, but the Russian compromise on him must be very strong. but maybe, and I realize we've been saying this for years, maybe this is the point at which the Republican Party says, okay, this guy's lost. I've kept my seat. We've actually done better in Congress than we expected. We've got 6 seats on the Supreme Court. We don't need you anymore. And maybe maybe that will be the crucial. I think looking at how the Republican leadership responds, and of course, many of those people are potential 2024 candidates thinking, yes, okay, Joe Biden is 78 years old or 77 now, but he'll be 78 when he's inaugurated. And he's not going to be able to get much done because it looks as though we're holding on to control of the Senate. So he'll have a weak, ineffectual administration. And I'm putting myself in pole position for 2024. And I don't want to run against Donald Trump Jr. I wonder if this may be the moment where that may be a break on Donald Trump's worst instincts in the coming weeks. But if we're relying on Donald Trump's instincts to ensure transition of power, the precedent isn't good.
No.
He cheats at golf. He cheats at everything. So he's not, he is not except, I don't see him, Al Gore's concession in 2000, which many people think was premature, was actually an act of kind of self-sacrifice and patriotism, as he saw. And I think there's something to that where he said, okay, who knows who won, but we can't have this.
Yeah.
One doesn't see Donald Trump taking that move.
No, one cannot.
So I think that the election was better than expected in terms of how it came out. I think the transition is going to be awful.
Yes. And we'll talk more about transitions, I guess, in future episodes, because I think transitions are interesting because they can go in a variety of different ways. And this one is going to be an unusual one if there is a transition.
Well, I think there probably won't be, for one thing. I mean, and let's not forget, these people would steal a hot stove. They are going to be pulling the copper wiring out of the walls of the White House on their way out the door. It's going to be extraordinary, even without the threat of unrest. Just
in 2000, there were reports that the Clinton people, as they were leaving, took the W's off the keyboard in the White House. And people said, well, that's horrific, in 2000. That's a real affront to American democracy. I think we're going to see a lot more than missing letters on a keyboard.
He's not getting his security deposit back on I'll tell you that. Oh,
we only paid $750, so it's fine. That's right. I think there's still lots more story here that's going to unfold in the days and weeks to come. And listeners, you may know more than we do, because that's the nature.
Yeah, by the time you listen to this, in fact, it's now, I was just looking at Georgia a minute ago. I think it was 400 and some odd votes, down from 655 is the difference. I mean, it looks like Biden might pull that out, which is great for Biden and the Democrats, but surely that there'll be a recount there as well as Wisconsin.
That seems to be the most likely scenario, yes.
Yeah.
And lots of other litigation in other places.
Yeah, although thus far the litigation doesn't seem to have much merit. I mean, they seem to be just throwing things at the wall to see what will stick, but the cases we don't have anything, as you said a minute ago, of the equivalent of the hanging chads in Florida. Mm. I mean, there were, look, Florida 2000 is a very complicated election, or the 2000 national election coming down to Florida is very complicated. There were legitimate legal differences to be adjudicated in Florida. Mm. That doesn't seem to be the case here.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I'm not an election expert and I'm not a lawyer. I have to stipulate.
Well,
both of those
but
things.
I think with throwing things at the wall to see what sticks, something might stick. You just need to get one sympathetic judge to change the whole ball game.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we will see how this unfolds in the days and weeks to come. Frank, you got a last drop?
I do. I want to endorse a book that's been out for a couple of years, but it's just a great book. It's Colin Calloway's The Indian World of George Washington.
Oh, that is a great book.
Yeah.
It won the George Washington
book prize. It did win the George Washington book prize a year or two ago. And it's an amazing book. And there's been a lot of emphasis about kind of decolonizing the curriculum and things like that. And then that's actually quite important work. And what Calloway's done is written a truly kind of indigenous history of George Washington's life. And his premise is looking at George Washington's lifetime engagement with Native America and Native Americans, going back to his very early life down to his death, really. And Colin just has some wonderful insights. He said, we always talk about George Washington speculating in Western lands, for example. Well, if you call those Western lands Indian lands, it takes on a totally different meaning.
Yeah.
And it's a simple thing like that. And just so George Washington, and I've lectured on this, you probably have as well. Mm. The traditional narrative, as a very young man, he's 21 years old in 1754, he blunders in Ohio and starts the Seven Years' War. That's the usual kind of narrative you get. Well, Calloway demonstrates that actually there was a Seneca leader with Washington who was leading Native indigenous soldiers at that encounter in Western Pennsylvania and led to the killing of a French officer. And Tanagrisson, the half king, as he was known, this Seneca chief, was in his 50s and not following George Washington's lead. Washington was following his lead. Yeah. And Tanna Greeson is the one who killed Jules Mundeville. I mean, that's been acknowledged, but usually it's presented as Washington lost control of Tanna Greeson. He never had control of Tanna Greeson. Anyway, these are the kind of just, it's a wonderful book. It's deeply researched. It's beautifully written. And it was a worthy winner of the Washington Prize. And I've had cause because of the chapter I'm working on at the moment to really give this book a close reading and kind of take it apart in the way that we do that kind of normal people don't. And it's just a fabulous book. So if you're looking for something that's not related to the election to read, Colin Calloway, George Washington's Indian World, or The Indian World of George Washington. It's just wonderful.
Excellent book.
Yeah. Yeah. David, what about you?
I was distracted by another election that actually happened yesterday. And it's an election that went on without incident, in which the results are not disputed. And maybe not disputed yet. We'll see. It's the election for the National Toy Hall of Fame.
Who votes in this? What is the electorate?
They have a panel of experts that decides among the nominees. Anybody can nominate a toy, but then they have sort of a list of candidates, and then they have a panel of experts that decide.
Sounds a lot like the Electoral College, David.
It does. It does. So they have decided who of the 12 finalists was going to make it in.
And how many make it out of the 12?
Well, so it varies from year to year. This is going on for a dozen years or more. But this year they inducted three toys.
Okay, so it's three out of 12.
Yeah, right. 12. Let me tell you here what the nominees were.
And listeners, I do not know any of this. David would not divulge any of this to me before the episode. So I am hearing this as you are.
I've been paying attention to this election for at least all week, just because it was a distraction. So here were the nominees. Bingo. Briar horses, which are little plastic horses. Jenga. Light Bright. Do you ever have a Light Bright, Frank?
No.
Okay.
Is that the thing where you plug lights into it, like it's almost
little
like
plastic
battleship
things? And you,
yeah, okay.
Light Bright.
No, I didn't have that, but.
Okay. The Masters of the Universe toys, that is to say He-Man and She-Ra. My Little Pony.
I could sing the song.
The new song or the old song? There's two different songs.
Of course you know that.
Risk. Sorry. Sidewalk Chalk. Baby Nancy. Tamagotchi and Yahtzee.
Okay. And what are the criteria? Do you have to be retired for 5 years, like in the Baseball Hall of Fame? Or
it's about toys that have a lasting significance and influence on the culture.
Right. And the culture is the United States or is it global?
Yes, it's the National Hall of Fame. It's in Rochester, New York. If people,
because like down. Risk is a French game. So I'm all right. So my response to these.
Yes.
If you're asking.
Yes, very much so. I'm curious about who you would have voted for.
I mean, I think
if we know you probably voted for on Tuesday, but if Toy Hall of Fame, which of these?
Okay.
Candidates?
So I think Bingo and Sidewalk Chalk are more almost concepts than you know they're not specific.
I should point out a few years ago they inducted the stick into the Toy Hall of Fame. So you have to look at previous, you know, there's a standard that's been set. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
The stick, okay.
Yes. Yeah. So they've got like Star Wars toys and the stick and
all right. Yeah. So there may be a category for things that are more conceptual, obviously. Yes. And I would put Bingo and Sidewalk Chalk in those. All right. I'm going to run through these. How many can I vote for? Can I vote for three?
You can vote for three.
And is that true for the actual voters, or do they just come up with three?
I don't actually know the mechanism for voting. I'll have to investigate that more. But yeah, the three people got inducted.
Well, for somebody who was quite preachy and judgy earlier in this podcast about voting requirements, I think you should know that. Okay, so all right, bingo is out because it's stupid. Briar horses, I don't know what they are, so they're out. Jenga's a maybe. Lightbright is out. Masters of the Universe, you know, He-Man is, I think given birth to a lot of memes, I think Masters of the Universe is still in. My Little Pony, not my thing, but I can see where there's a constituency for it. So that's a maybe. Risk is a maybe. Baby Nancy's out. Sidewalk Chalk is out. Tamagotchi, boring. And Tamagotchi was more of a trend. Hmm. Although I suspect it's in the Japanese Toy Hall of Fame because I think it was a trend for a couple of years, but I'm not sure it really took. Yahtzee's a classic. There are only so many board games we can have, though. So I would probably eliminate them because I love Risk. So I would have Risk. So it comes down to Jenga, Masters of the Universe, My Little Pony, and Risk. I think it's probably Risk, My Little Pony, and Jenga. That's what I would vote for. Okay. Although I'm sorely tempted by Masters of the Universe. But Masters of the Universe isn't a toy. So, you know, it's a cartoon that spun off toys.
No, it was a toy that spun off a cartoon.
Is that true? All right.
Yeah, so well, that was back in the 80s where they had the toys and then they had the half-hour-long commercials for them that children watched.
You see, I'm a little too old.
It's like Transformers and that's the whole...
Right. Okay.
All
right,
G.I. Joe, the whole thing.
Anyway, I'm sticking with my... I have one for the kids. I have My Little Pony. I have Risk for the teenagers and Jenga's for everybody. So that's my ballot.
The winners were... You were right about Jenga. The second winner is Sidewalk Chalk.
God.
And the third winner was Baby Nancy. Do you know about Baby Nancy? Baby Nancy was the first African-American doll that was designed for and by African-Americans. Introduced in 1968.
Right. I did not know Baby Nancy. So hence she did not receive my vote. Interesting. So do toys lose eligibility in subsequent years?
No, I think they may be there. Some of these finalists may show up again next year. But Baby Nancy, Jenga, and Sidewalk Chalk are the new. We should congratulate them on their induction.
I look forward to their speeches. I look forward to their acceptance speeches. I guess Sidewalk Chalk has, of course, had a comeback during the lockdown because it became a thing.
And so, Baby Nancy is appropriate in a Black Lives Matter moment.
Right. No. Okay. Yeah. I get that.
Jenga, everything's falling apart. Right. That makes sense.
But My Little Pony is a. Come on!
I was my daughter was pulling for My Little Pony, and I think there's a claim to be made for them being there. But
are you a Risk fan?
I like Risk. Yeah, right. Yeah. Risk is a very good game, but it's about domination, and I'm not sure we need any more of that kind of.
Of that kind of thing.
Yeah. Taking over the world seems like a bad move for right now. We should encourage other kinds of play.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you have the results of the most important vote this week.
Exactly. Something that maybe will also be in dispute. Maybe they'll have a runoff or something, right?
Yes, My Little Pony's going to sue.
Too, exactly. Recount.
He-Man will not accept this result.
Results. He-Man and Skeletor will team up with the My Little Pony crew. Put up a lawsuit. Great. Until next week, Frank, when we may know more things. Cheers.
Let's hope. Cheers, David. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.